you're asking him, Pat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Before we get started, I do have some housekeeping to go through, some boring housekeeping. There were some typos in the paper. There's one substantive one, and there are some paragraph references missing. I just want to point out the one substantive one, which is quite important. In our paragraph 40B of Agenda Paper 5A, we are missing a not, which in many cases is quite important. And the not should be in between the would and the be independent. So it would not be independent, which I'm sure most of you would have picked that up.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Sorry, which paragraph?
40B.
Paper 5A.
Third line.
Would be, would not be.
Yeah, but which sentence? The first or the second?
First sentence. The end of it.
Oh, would not be.
Yep, would not be independent. Okay.
The paragraph X actually exists, right?
Paragraph X does exist. If you want, I can go through
those. So just to remind people out there that paragraph X is in this paper.
It is within this paper.
You have to guess which one. We'll give you a prize.
If you are ready, you should know which paragraph it is.
Okay. All right. So just briefly, the cover paper, Agenda Paper 5 includes a summary of what we've covered in previous sessions, just like usual. As requested last time, we have started to sort of start building up a table or a matrix as we develop the approaches. We'll continue to populate that matrix to show what the different classification of the instruments we consider would be. So as requested, we'll continue to do that going forward. The main paper for today's session is Agenda Paper 5A. It's a long paper, and we know it's a bit complicated.
Can I just ask you, going back 1 minute to paper 5,
yes,
paragraph 10, I think we can do a little bit better in terms of communicating the differences between assessment A and B. Because the wording, when you speak of as and when they fall due in comparison to at a point in time, is not perfectly clear, because the point in time could be the same as when they fall due. I think we could probably be a bit more, make it easier for people to understand. Because every time I read again this, I stumble with that.
I think there are probably some other points on the approaches that we've thought about since last meeting that we think could be improved. And as we develop those approaches, we'll start to bring those comments in and start to flesh them out a bit more. And I think going through that process, we can really refine exactly what we're trying to get to. Anything else on agenda paper 5?
We could say at any point in time. When we say at a point in time, do we really mean at any point in time?
Yeah, perhaps. I don't want to get into that discussion.
But it's important to understand the logic.
Any
point in time could be only one. Any point is a variation over time.
Yeah. Okay.
Just can I make a clarity?
Yeah.
Can I ask a question about the paragraph 13 of the agenda paper 5, that you show the table.
Yes.
This table is very straightforward and understandable, but if you go to the gamma, then the everything other than ordinary shares is a liability.
Well, everything that we've considered thus far. Yeah. So these are just the limited population of instruments.
Is the point I just want to raise. So if you only look at this example, it looks like everything other than ordinary share looks liability. But as you said, there are other populations. So I just want you to elaborate what is the difference between the gamma approach and the basic ownership approach. approach.
Yeah.
So the approach itself is completely different. But
yes.
You know, if you look at this table, it looks like quite similar to the basic owner's approach.
I think it's more a tuck what you're saying, a communication point in saying that this is not, although it looks similar, it's different and it's not the basic ownership approach.
Yeah.
And make it clear that this is only the limited population of instruments so that people don't get an impression otherwise, right?
Right.
Yeah. Fair.
Okay. Agenda paper 5A. As I was saying, this, just bear with us, this is it is a bit more meaty than past papers. So long, in fact, that we had to enlist Daniela from the conceptual framework team to help us on the harder parts. That team is now considering whether that's a repo transaction or some kind of, or just a simple financing transaction. But Daniela is going to be shortly going back to work on that important project. But we are going to just to let you know, we're planning to split this discussion a bit into two. We're going to turn it over to the board after we go through some context and through the fix for fixed portion and get your comments on that, and then we'll talk about the redemption obligation part, which is the second part of the paper. We aren't asking you to make any decisions at this board meeting, so it is partly educational. But we would like to know whether you have any comments or questions on the analysis and potentially more importantly whether you need further analysis on specific points in the future. It's important for us to know whether you acknowledge some of the trade-offs and consequences of some of those points that we raised in the paper, particularly for fix for fix, because they will shape how we develop the approaches going forward. So that's what we're really looking to get out of this meeting. Before I get into the detail of, well, not the detail, but before I go through the main points of fix for fix, I just wanted to make a few remarks regarding the context for this paper, how it fits in with our previous discussions, and where some of the key linkages are. Last month, we looked at the requirements in IS 32. For non-derivatives, and we set out three approaches that are summarized in the cover paper that we intend to develop in future sessions. And those approaches will hopefully help us clarify what the underlying rationale of IS 32 is regarding the distinction from non-derivative instruments. As part of developing those approaches, we will inevitably have to deal with derivatives on own equity. To do that, we need to understand what the additional challenges derivatives on own equity add to what we've already discussed. Now, the key point about derivatives on own equity is that they are contracts which combine their exchange contracts with two sides of the exchange, where one of those legs would meet the definition of equity in isolation. And so it's the addition of this other side, the other leg, which does not meet the definition of equity, which adds an additional layer of complexity. And so we're just going through and looking at the consequences of those. The consequences arise because, of course, the accounting for equity is quite different for assets and liabilities, in particular for performance, but also on the balance sheet. With regards to the financial statement totals. In previous meetings, when we're looking at non-derivatives, we're really focusing on the features of non-derivative financial instruments to see what features are relevant and how different features affect prospects for future cash flows. All those things are still important, and the features that we use to distinguish between non-derivative financial instruments will determine what types of derivatives are going to be relevant for those different approaches. However, the underlying challenges are going to be quite similar, because under all three approaches, we're going to have situations where we're combining something that meets the definition of equity with something that does not. And so that's, again, that's a key point. And of course, the populations will be different. And so, for example, under different approaches, for instance, under the alpha approach, whether a derivative is net settled or gross settled will have some relevance under that approach, and we'll be looking at those issues when we're developing that approach. And for the beta approach, how the amount of cash or number of shares changes, how that varies, will be relevant for that approach, and we'll be looking at that as we develop that approach. So we'll look at those implications as we develop those approaches, and we'll think about how we might need to amend the requirements that we're looking at today in order to accommodate those approaches at some future point in time. So what we'd like to do today is just focus on those general problems, gain an understanding of those general problems before we move on. And so in order to do that, what we've tried to do in this paper is use some examples which the challenges for which would be common under all three approaches. Okay, so we can use them as generic examples that would be relevant under all three. We have set out the analysis, as I said, we've distinguished between the fixed-for-fixed condition, which applies for all derivatives, and we have, in the second part of the paper, we've looked at the redemption obligation requirements. That does not apply to all derivatives, only to those derivatives where we're extinguishing an equity instrument in exchange for something that meets the definition of a liability. Okay. So I'll move on to fix for fix now. In paragraphs 46 to 69, we provide an analysis of the so-called fix for fix condition. The fix for fix condition applies to derivatives in their entirety, and that is a key point, and it does not distinguish between the underlying equity and non-equity legs. So in other words, if the fix for fix condition is met, the whole instrument is classified as equity, and in all other cases, the whole instrument will be classified as either a financial asset or a liability. In paragraphs 53 to 60, we illustrate three examples just to show the application of this and the consequences of this. In the first example, fixed for fixed is met. In the second one, the example meets the foreign currency rights issue exception. We just assume it does, just to show the effects of that. And in the third one, the instrument fails fix for fix, and it's an asset or liability. In paragraph 61 to 69, we summarize the pros and cons of this approach. So on the one hand, the fix for fix condition is a pragmatic approach that alleviates the need to componentize derivatives in minute and microscopic detail. On the other hand, it is a blunt tool. And a disadvantage is that for derivatives that are not fixed for fixed, changes in the equity leg could end up being accounted for as if they're assets or liabilities. So as illustrated in example three, changes in the asset leg changes in the equity leg are accounted for as income and expense. Whereas in example two, we have the opposite. And because it meets the foreign currency rights issue exception, we have changes in the asset leg not being reported as income and expense. So these are some of the key trade-offs. And again, these challenges arise mainly because of the combination of the equity part of the contract with the non-equity part of the contract. And I just want to reiterate, these challenges will remain regardless which of the three approaches we're going to be developing. And so this is going to be one of the key trade-offs that we're going to have to either accept or however, we are going to be developing those approaches and consider what changes to fix for fix we will need to make in order to implement those approaches. We'll also consider at future sessions changes to fix for fix and the guidance around that to address some of the application issues that we've identified in the paper. We haven't gone into too much detail into the application issues because first we want to set the framework and start to develop the approaches further, and then we'll look into those because hopefully some of those might fall away. However, eliminating all the disadvantages of fix for fix will require an approach that componentizes derivatives in tiny and microscopic detail by disentangling all those different aspects, which is going to be, and the trade-off there is the complexity of applying such an approach versus the conceptual purity. I'll just turn it over to the board now. To happy to receive any comments or suggestions for future sessions.
Darryl?
I guess I just wanted to clarify, and I think you sort of covered it right at the end of the discussion there. Essentially, one of the reasons why we have a difficulty with fixed for fixed, and in fact to go a step further, why we have a difficulty with the exchange rate mechanism in fixed for fixed, is essentially both of them are exceptions to the general process. Ideally, we would say, as applying a starting point or applying the thought process from the beginning, we would say that we would want to split equity from the asset or the liability component. If we did that, we would be outside of the fixed-for-fixed realm, and I'm guessing that A, B, and C, or alpha, beta, and gamma, would produce the outcomes we expect them to produce for all other products. So I think for me there's sort of almost two elements here. The first is that we are making an operational decision, assuming we stick with fixed-for-fixed, we're making an operational decision to make something easier, and as a consequence of that, creating a lot of additional complexity. And then if we were to retain the exchange rate, then we're making a second operational exception to the process. And I wondered whether, as part of the discussion we're likely to have in the future, we would consider those two operational exceptions, which add complexity, to be something that we would not require, but rather permit, just because it seems to make the whole thing a lot more complex.
Just in terms of not requiring or permitting something, I think one of the... There are some, if it's not fixed for fixed, then we get some of these anomalies. However, I think we kind of need to be a bit careful about introducing options, because the problem with that type of approach would be we'd end up accounting for similar things in different ways. I mean, sure, there's an operational exception to this, perhaps, or it's a practical, it's a blunt instrument, but it applies consistently. To some extent, it applies consistently across these derivatives, and to some extent, especially if we look at the equity leg of the fixed for fixed kind of condition, that is consistent with how we define financial liability in IAS 32. And so if you have a variable number of equity instruments, then that is consistent with the notion that, okay, if it's only a fixed number of instruments, then it's equity. And so I think there's some limitations to how we can think about trying to get some kind of pure approach that eliminates some of these anomalies without opening it up to opportunities to...
So can I perhaps take half a step backwards there, though, because I think when you talk about fixed for fixed or something else, I'm not sure in that circumstance if you're talking about a something else that is kind of bifurcation into the equity element and the non-equity element, or some kind of other operational expedient.
It would be, well, in order to eliminate the disadvantages of fixed for fixed, we would have to develop, and if we wanted people to have the option of doing it, we would have to develop a more sophisticated approach to componentization.
So then maybe the important starting question for me would be, if we were to have a more sophisticated way of breaking it up. That then presumably solves all of these issues. So that is the point at which we are diverting from the pure model into something that is slightly...
It would avoid, I mean, if we wanted to be completely clean and avoid some of the conceptual issues of including some changes in equity and, you know, income and expense, etc. Sure. But don't underestimate how complex such an approach would be.
I mean, part of the concern is it's a blunt instrument, because arguably there are circumstances in which the tools are available to make that split. but essentially by saying we go down the fixed route, we shut out those opportunities for doing it, either because of the simplicity of the instrument or the sophistication of the preparer.
Exactly, Darrell. I think that's what you have articulated it. What I would say is that the trade-offs, what we're saying is that when you look at derivatives in combination, that's the trade-off immediately, because we are not splitting it further. Yes, if you have to do, it sounds like some of you might remember as deja vu for me for reassessed, we did explore that before. The other complex way is to split up the derivative so that you have the pure asset or liability leg and the equity leg, although there's an interaction between that, and then you look at it. And that is where I think, where I would say the practical exception comes in, because it becomes incredibly complex to do that. That split is not easy. It's easy to consider a forward. It's one leg. It's a linear one-leg instrument, or even a swap, although the swap gives it. But think of an option. How do I break that up with an equity which is probability-weighted? And that's what the previous approaches looked at. And for me, the ultimate complexity is take it forward and think, when we are looking at actual real life, a cocoa. What is the replicating portfolio for that? And that is, I think, the key question which we're saying is that this is a trade-off. So any approach we look at when developing will have this trade-off. We are not proposing that we explore the componentization unless we hear otherwise.
Well, then, Kumar, I think you've answered my other question, which is essentially, so what we're suggesting with this paper is we will go ahead with fixed for fixed.
Or a variation of that, and see how we can address, yes. And we will run that through. But yes, I don't think initially, if you look at approach gamma, it's a major variation from that what we are saying as of now.
So
I want to try and take it back a step and try and use your concepts to help us build back up to fix for fix, because I think we're trying to partly look at what's in 32, partly to use your concepts, right? So if I look at the fix for fixed examples 1, 2, and 3, what was useful for me in that was it shows how, because of the sort of, it shows the more things you add in, the more variability you have that's coming in for things other than the equity, but you've still got the equity part as well. So you've got a mixture of things in 2 and 3, and 1's pure equity. So that was useful, and it shows how fix for fix sort of has a very binary outcome. You capture all the variability, including the equity variability, or none.
Yep.
Yeah. But what I wasn't sure the analysis that we're using helped me answer was what I thought the right accounting was for the most simple instrument, so the fixed for fixed.
Yep.
So in 32, that's an equity instrument, so it's just, you know, not remeasured. But if I look at the tools that we're using to develop our thinking, and if I look at your alpha, beta, gamma, and distill them down to thinking about concepts of liquidity and solvency, in this situation, which is a situation where the entity is issuing its own shares and a fixed number of its own shares and is the recipient of an asset of some kind, a fixed amount of cash or something more complicated, and let's say in the first instance it's a fixed amount of cash. Mm-hmm. For me, if my contract is I'm going to give you 5 shares and you're going to give me 100 of my functional currency, if you ask me whether that's got a consequence for liquidity or solvency, my answer would be no. So I don't really care. Yeah, I know I'm definitely going to get 100, ignoring credit risk, so I'm not exposed to any sort of liquidity or solvency effect of entering into that contract. I just have to give you my own shares, which for a fixed number.
But might make your solvency or liquidity better.
But very indirectly. So all of the other instruments we're looking at before have been, do I have an obligation as a result of this instrument to write a check or not?
Yep.
It's been that sort of thinking. And here, I'm the recipient of an asset, so it's the flip side of what we've looked at before, which is your point about a derivative being more complicated because it's two legs.
Yep.
But I didn't feel like the alpha, beta, gamma helped me answer the question of what I should think about when I just look at the pure example one fixed for fixed transaction. And I wondered whether the only way to decide how you need to think about the fixed for fixed, and therefore even decide whether you agree that that simple instrument should just be something that's measured as an equity instrument or thought about as an equity instrument, which is sort of set and forget is correct, would be whether you needed to start thinking about whether from a performance perspective the valuation effects that you're seeing in example one actually matter.
Yep.
And the analysis in the paper didn't ask me that question, because it's using only the liquidity and solvency type thinking of alpha, beta, and gamma, and it's sort of saying, it's sort of implied to me that because of the asset leg, I should be thinking about liquidity and solvency, but it didn't convince me that that was true.
there is
Am I silly?
No, it's no, they're fair comments. I think when I was looking at it, I was trying to sort of limit sort of the solvency and liquidity thinking to just what is that equity leg. And so I didn't expand it to the asset leg, and I think that's your question. If we expand that to the asset leg, where does that take us? The other thing is when we talk
50A, you did talk about the asset leg and started talking about liquidation and things, and so that's what threw me, because it wouldn't have been the way I would have thought about it. When you look at the derivatives going the other direction, where I've got to receive my shares and pay cash, then yes, I would think about it, but not when I'm the recipient.
But I think that's also why we try to split out the derivatives between when we're receiving an asset and issuing equity versus those where we're swapping liabilities and equity. Because I think when we're swapping liabilities and equity, those tools that we've built up over the time kind of make a bit more sense and help us a little bit more to think about those situations. But when we're receiving an asset, I think perhaps some additional thinking might be needed.
I think we do need it, because for me, other than saying today in 32, fixed for fixed is equity, therefore that's the correct answer, I didn't feel like I had, what I thought we needed in this project was to understand better why we thought fixed for fixed should be equity, so that I then have that anchor to develop my thinking and decide where I've got anomalies and problems and what I need to fix and how I could clarify the thinking. And I didn't feel like I had that anchor from this analysis, I guess is what I'm saying.
The other point I wanted to make was that at least some of the approaches, we bring in the performance reporting considerations. So I think there might be a hook to consider fix for fix in that light. And some of the analysis that we use to explain the consequences of these types of instruments really looked at how things change and whether we're taking changes in equity instruments, which we, whatever we decide to be equity, we say we don't want going through income and expense, and taking those changes through income and expense if it fails fix for fix.
I think it should be equity.
Yeah, and if it meets fix for fix, then the only changes, or if it's pure fix for fix, a pure fixed amount of functional currency of cash, then the only changes that would result from that type of instrument would be driven from the equity leg.
Exactly. So for me, for the entity, that's not that much different to getting cash of 100 today and issuing you an ordinary share.
Yeah.
Your share might be worth more or less in the future. I don't really care. I've got my $100.
Yes.
And I don't see that as being that different to the fix for fix, but I know that not everybody holds that view. Okay. So for me to get my equity classification for my pure fix for fix, you need to help me with a better argument that we can then use to develop our thinking.
I think one of the challenges we also have in fixed or fixed is to, how do you define fixed or fixed? What does it mean in application?
But we also need to know why we think it's okay.
And that's how that will help
then
us.
Then it will help us.
Exactly. I think it's a good point, and I think it comes back to the point about it being really binary. And it does link in also with the fact that if you have an obligation to issue a fixed number of ordinary shares, for instance, I think under each of the approaches, that non-derivative obligation would be equity. And so if we're receiving, as you say, if we're receiving a fixed amount of cash in exchange for that, does that really change? Is that really different to just receiving the cash and issuing the shares? But I think in that case, I mean, personally, and just thinking on the fly, and I haven't thought about it too much, but splitting out or componentizing that type of thing why bother? I mean, and that's where the practical considerations come into
it. I wouldn't personally want to do it, but you can see there are changes in value going on, and some people might think they're relevant, but we need to work out why we do or don't think that's relevant.
I have the answer of it. I have an answer of that question.
Well, Philip, give us the answer.
Yeah, well, maybe I can try. The value of that contract, which is shown on table 1 or table 2, the value to whom? Not to the entity itself, but to the shareholders of either one class of shareholders in table 2. Scenario 2, we have two classes of shareholders. The ones that will subscribe or not subscribe to the foreign currency rights issue,
as opposed to the ones in the other class of shareholders, which is in local or reporting currency. And it is a transfer of value. It is a dilution or relution between the two classes of shareholders. In the more simple scenario, table one, if every shareholder subscribes in proportion to their existing rights, no impact. The value of the contract will be split evenly between them. If only one part of the shareholder subscribes to the share issue, there will be a transfer of value between the ones who do not subscribe and the one who subscribe. The value is the value of the contract. We are not accounting for the shareholders, we are accounting for the reporting entity, conceptual framework. So this is why we don't care, between commas, about booking that for the entity. But if we were accounting for the shareholders, if we were reporting the value to shareholders, then we would have to book something, a transfer of value between different classes of shareholders. So I think this is conceptually because we have decided to limit the scope of reporting to the reporting entity and not to include the shareholders in that scope of reporting, that we can say it has no impact on solvency, no impact on liquidity. It's only the third dimension, which is information useful to investors, existing or potential investors, i.e. disclosures of the effect of this contract, which is important. It is not mentioned in this paper as disclosures on top of the accounting.
But just one point on that, Philippe. I mean, these aren't contracts purely between shareholders. Yeah. I mean, these are contracts that the entity is entered into, and so they would affect the prospects for future cash flows, because in some future point in time, instead of issuing the shares at that point in time, at the fair value at that point in time, they've agreed beforehand to issue them for some different price, and so that has an effect on what they can receive for issuing the shares.
I agree. This is why disclosure is absolutely important here. But it's not cash flows to the entity. It's cash flows to the shareholder.
No, but the entity will receive the cash from the contract.
Yeah, but as we said, it's equal value.
The equity side, the issuing shares, which are equal in value to the other shareholders, but what they're receiving as a result of these contracts is a predetermined amount. So they've entered into a contract to issue these shares at a predetermined amount. And the question is how that predetermined amount changes, how do we represent that in the financial statements? The entity is going to receive the cash, but the question is, at the reporting date, the entities entered into that contract to issue those shares for that amount. That will affect the entity's future cash flows. It will receive 100 or something that changes as a result of foreign currency. So there is an effect on the entity, I think.
Well, let's assume, table one, the value of cash receivable doesn't change. It's fixed, fixed amount. So this asset leg will not change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What will change is the liability, the equity leg.
Yes.
Because there is no change in cash flows. There is only a dilution effect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, but when you have variability...
But that meets the fixed-for-fixed condition, and I think...
It's okay to say it's equity. But there is a dimension of dilution or relution of shareholders which is extremely important and should be disclosed.
But for the ones that in Table 2 where the value of the cash changes, Philippe, Would you say the same thing?
That's become a bit more complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we're trying to.
Yeah.
Performance, doesn't it?
Mary.
A few thoughts. Let me start by going back to what Sue was saying about whether the alpha, beta, gamma are useful for analyzing this. I think what I took out of that comment was that alpha, beta, gamma all seem to be focusing on different ways of looking at obligations for outflows. Yeah. So that when you look at an example that, you know, when we move to derivatives, which have inflow legs as well as outflows, that within the tools are not suddenly as effective because we're having to think about the inflow leg. And so, you know, that does raise the question about whether there's a performance or other aspect or another tool that isn't as outflow oriented that we need to consider in thinking that. That is, Sue, is that fair? Okay. Because that I thought, in terms of what we ask the staff to do and, you know, further work, it's the realization that when you come to things like these derivatives, we need a tool that can deal with that aspect as well, and what should we look to? Sorry, I don't have any answers for you on that one. In looking at this paper, in this section of the paper, one thing that struck me is the work really brought home to me in a way I hadn't thought about before, that as you've been saying, the blunt instrument that is fixed for fixed, that says you don't separate, means that as soon as you have variability on the asset side, because we're looking at asset exchange contracts, it would be the same in the liability exchange. As soon as you get variability in that aspect, you then suddenly sweep in all the variability in the equity side, which normally we don't account for. And so the fixed for fixed ends up dragging in something that we normally would exclude, from measurement. And I hadn't, I guess if you'd made me sit down and think about it before, I could have worked to that, but this just really brought that home. And that does raise the question for me, in terms of what more work do we want the staff to do, about whether this tool is blunter than we want it to be, and whether that the bluntness of it is something that's creating some of the problems. Now, I think, like Daryl, if I was following his remarks properly, I don't have an appetite for going a radically different direction in terms of absolute splitting out of all the elements. And I think what we're alluding to is something that was explored 5 or 6 or 7 years ago in the reassessed expected outcome, which I think at the time that was evaluated was shown as incredibly complicated and costly to apply. But so when I think about kind of sticking with blunt tools, but maybe just sharpening them a little, what
sharp
comes?
Hammer.
Yeah, maybe a sharper hammer is probably the right characterization. it is whether there are additional circumstances.
Yep.
In which we pull out if there are additional circumstances in which we should be separating. And the first thought that comes to me, and it may be an idea that doesn't fly, I throw it your way and let you evaluate it outside of the meeting, is are there more circumstances in which we should be pulling out an obligation to issue shares for fair value, for their fair value? Because normally when you think outside of derivatives, if I buy or sell my own equity instruments, that transaction is recognized in equity with the amount paid versus the accumulated residual book value just being a debit or credit to equity. And I don't know if there are more circumstances in which we should be decomposing selected transactions to say there's a leg that is buy or sell at fair value, and then it's the other variability we want to capture. Now, and thinking about it that way. So that's my request, with the awareness raised about the consequences of the blunt instrument. What strikes me is what we might want to think about exploring is whether there are more instances in which we should look to do some kind of separation to pull out specifically buy or sell at fair value, because the idea that what as you show in examples 2 and 3, as soon as you get variability, you're sweeping in not just the variability of the consideration, but also through your own your P&L fluctuations in the value of your own shares. And that's something that, you go back 15 years ago, the SIC said, no, you don't book gains and losses on treasury share transactions through P&L. And it's a collateral damage of using a blunt instrument. It's the wall around the nail. But that's where I say, can we look harder?
We are, as I think I mentioned, we are going to look at some specific types that are relevant for different approaches. And I think one of those is when you have these contracts to buy, sell, or options to buy and sell at some at fair value, because I think the outcomes under the different approaches mm-hmm. might be different for those. But I think the difficult thing is to separate out those underlying legs.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's
yeah.
I think that's really the trick. Under all these derivatives, I think that's
yeah.
that's where the complexity comes from, because especially when you have an option, the two legs are so inextricably linked that separating them out without some incredibly complex method of doing that is difficult. Now, we can identify where, for instance, the special cases of the two legs, like the fair value forwards, or perhaps where there are fully net settled in shares or net settled in cash, which are relevant for some of the approaches. We can identify those cases, and for each approach we can think about requirements for them. But I think just if we just look at the general case, we're always going to have this problem where we're going to have these situations where we have the underlying leg being equity, and we're going to have to, unless we do that separation, we're going to have some kind of a blunt instrument and a binary outcome. And perhaps by chiseling out or scalping out those,
I like chiseling.
Chiseling out those special cases will help alleviate some of those tensions.
Yeah,
the first time we've bifurcated a derivative.
Yeah, but yeah, usually we bifurcate derivatives out of another instrument. Not I think.
And that may be the reason. That may be the reason not to go down that route in the end.
Yeah.
Because it creates such a precedent about bifurcating derivatives, but it's just in terms of what I would like to explore
in the future,
and I guess the other thing that I'd lob in here is, in a couple of places there seem to be concern about how we would either incorporate the thinking behind the foreign currency exception. Either we find a route that when we look at that exception through the lens, the filter of the tool, it suddenly lines up as less of an outlier, or we keep it or don't keep it as an exception. And I wouldn't worry about having to rationalize something that's identified as an exception. Let's just don't let that become the thing that prevents us from getting to an all over better answer.
Sort of in a similar line of thinking to Mary, really, and triggered by Sue's challenge to us to think about why fixed for fixed works in the cases where you pass fixed for fixed. So if you think about the cases where you start off with, you pass fixed for fixed, where you're receiving an asset and you're issuing an XE instrument, and then the first sort of basic tweak we have is where we've got some variability in the asset side, but nothing on the liability side. And listening to the discussion, it actually strikes me as extremely strange that if the only thing that happens is you import some variability into the asset leg, what you do in effect is reclassify the equity leg. That just seems like a very odd outcome. And so maybe what we should be doing is where we've got some variability just coming into the asset leg, we should be thinking about how to deal with that. And maybe it's accounting for the pieces gross or componentizing, or maybe it's looking at the equity leg and saying, well, okay, an equity leg, we're not normally going to account for changes in that, so maybe somehow we should freeze that leg in accounting for the net position if we're still looking at the net position. So just thinking of that specific case, I'm not talking about doing that more generally, but maybe that would help us sort of nibble away at the edges a bit for the things that only fail because there's variability on the asset side.
Stephen?
Manuel, is there any one way to componentize or one way to think about it? So we've got this REO and it was very complicated and I remember it vaguely. It was so long ago. But what about componentizing for presentation in terms of performance? I mean, people have mentioned performance already, and that is the key thing that we've not really talked about yet. So is there any way of thinking about componentization from that perspective?
I think any time we think about componentization, that brings into consideration, especially for derivatives, we have to think about it hand in hand with measurement. And I think it's, regardless of where we do it, whether it's for the performance statement or for the balance sheet or for classification, it is going to be the same type of problem. that we're going to have to deal with. So even if we want to split out those changes, splitting out those changes is not going to be a trivial kind of exercise. We'll still have to go through the same exercise of isolating those changes from the other changes. And for a simple forward, and the types of things that we looked at in this paper, it looks quite simple. As Kumar said, it's kind of linear. But when we start to think about options, where actually the value of the option is interrelated with the two legs, because you have the time value and the risk of the two legs coming into it, it becomes, I think, incredibly complex without going to an approach like reassess the expected outcomes to split those out.
Can I just give an example, thinking, which we had to work on, even with the sample forwards? Let's take the foreign currency bit, and assuming it does not meet the exception. So I have a variability coming from the foreign currency on the asset leg or the cash leg, and the equity leg is fixed. So if I were to split that out, I have to create, first take that as a derivative, then I have to split it up within two components. One, which somehow has got a fixed asset leg, and another hypothetical forward which converts that. And that is that hypothetical forward that converts the fixed functional currency leg into the foreign currency leg of the contract. Remember, doesn't exist in the contract because that variability is there. That is the bit then I will have to use or target to remeasure. So even chiseling at the edges for these things, for where there are multiple elements going, is not going to be simple. But I do agree with the suggestion that if that is a challenge, maybe it's big enough where we can look at some of these things on the boundaries to see if we can find a solution on that, on the performance. But even with the simple instruments, I don't think I would say it's going to be simple to extract out the two variables. Or in derivative terms, these are quanto instruments because one of them affects the other, so I'll have to break that up. So even with a simple foreign currency forward, I'm going to have to decompose it into multiple layers.
And I think the problem we have at the moment is that it makes things very difficult for the investor. So we have example one just not represented at all, and although as a current common shareholder I'm suffering the dilution or I'm getting these gains and losses, I just don't see it. So there's a lack of information there, I think. Okay, it vaguely comes into a diluted earnings per share, but it's not really very good. Then you add in a foreign currency and you don't meet the exception, and suddenly all the accounting changes.
Bang, you have got a huge thing.
And you're just totally confused. Yeah.
I agree.
And I think we need to find a way of resolving that.
But in either we develop a complex way of componentizing it and push the costs of that to the preparers, or perhaps if we, for instance, have better disclosures about some of this, about the terms, if an investor wants to do some type of componentization to pull those bits out, they have the information needed to do it. Again, this is the trade-off we have. Otherwise, someone's going to eventually bear the costs of pulling these things or understanding how these things affect the entity's prospects for future cash flows. It's simply about what the best way to do that is and how we balance those trade-offs.
Do you think the basic ownership approach is off the table?
Yes. The difficulty with going, this has always been one of the benefits of the basic ownership approach, because all derivatives on own equity would be liabilities and equity. However, that doesn't solve the performance reporting aspects. And so the basic ownership approach, we just have the most residual class is equity, which is fine. However, you would still get all these changes in, and for instance, if under that approach, if you had a fixed for fixed instrument, it would be classified as a liability or an asset.
So this 20 and 20 would
flow
appear as gains and losses. But then you need a performance reporting overlay solution.
But you eventually have to deal with this problem one way or another.
Back to the future.
But you eventually have to deal with it one way or another.
Also,
so even if you go that approach, you have to deal with it.
All the complaints we get at the moment about derivatives are the stuff that ends up getting remeasured. If you go to basic ownership, everything's going to get remeasured, so it's not going to going to make you more popular.
Depends on, but it depends on where it's presented.
I don't think it was a
concern.
I don't think that was his concern at all.
But we have to deal with these issues one way or another. And so we either deal with them in terms of classification and let the financial reporting, I guess the performance consequences, flow from that, or we go for the basic ownership approach. But then we again have to deal with the performance reporting aspects one way or another. And so I think there's probably no
easy solution
that is a low-cost approach to delivering consistent and clear information to users with a low.
But haven't you just articulated one? You essentially described, in response to Steve's question, and my thinking is more or less aligned with I think where his questions are going, is that you would have a comprehensive and consistent way of classifying instruments, and I think that more faithfully represent the rights and obligations. The thorniness of that is, as Sue mentions, all of these derivatives get remeasured. But really, the real thorniness of that is where that remeasurement is presented.
Yeah.
So if we come up with a solution to present them, okay, outside of profit and loss, okay, then that presumably would be acceptable to many people.
But again, Pat, the issue, you'd still have this same problem where you'd have some changes which result from the underlying equity instrument and some changes that do not. And
no,
you
all outside P&L.
Yeah,
I don't
disagree. You would eventually meet the same type of issue, and you would have to think about how do we split this between P&L and outside. So there's no kind of shortcut way of dealing with this issue that resolves that central problem.
I hear you, but I heard you also, which was interesting, getting a little bit on the defensive side when Philippe was talking, okay?
Sorry, yeah.
And I thought that was good in the sense, if the paradigm and the lens you're asking us to look at these questions through, and you've been leading us since whatever, March, May, whatever, is what information is relevant, right, and how you communicate that information. And I think that's exactly what we should be doing. Then there is a difference in the answer to the question that Suzanne presented earlier. If I give you cash today for $100 and you give me shares, there's a difference between that and a situation where I promise to give you shares 6 months from now and you give me $100. There's a economic difference. And it's not just to the shareholders. It affects the reporting entity.
Yeah,
now, what is, let me just finish.
Come back to that.
What is the relevant information that should be communicated there? And how do you communicate? Yeah. Those are the right questions to ask. So in my mind, the most consistent way to do that is, frankly, to develop a more sophisticated approach, okay, to the separation of the various rights and obligations. Now, as Kumar counsels us, this is very complicated. Okay, I'm not saying we definitely should go there, but I don't think we should, at this stage of the project, just kind of throw out the REO approach. Maybe, as you just mentioned, there is an alternative way to apply some of the thinking in the REO approach, so we're not pushing a lot of this cost down to the preparer. So I think if you are acknowledging that the tools we have today are blunt, but yet you don't want to necessarily refine the tools too much because you don't like the outcomes, then you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Well, it's not because we don't like the outcomes.
No.
I think it's we're just acknowledging that there's a trade-off there.
Well, I think it is about we don't like the outcomes.
No, but
it's all about reporting changes in derivatives through profit and loss.
I don't think so. It's with REO, it's not something, believe me, if that is applied to the full, you will get all the challenges that Steve and others were talking about,
yeah,
refined to the point where you can really pick out the pieces. The whole two-leg problem goes away. I wouldn't say whole, but yes, we have a pretty powerful tool to lens to focus it and give the information. As I said, the trade-off always was complexity, and I won't mention names, and the last things was, which we were told at the board table by somebody, was pigs will fly if people think it can be done over the point. And it was no mean board member who mentioned that. It's a complexity. And very clearly, it's the complexity that comes with it and the applicability of how many people other than the banks can even apply this.
Well, as I always like to say, this instrument didn't exist 10 years ago.
Yes,
and yet my father, my 91-year-old father, is extremely conversant with how to use it today, okay? You have to do is push buttons. So present value calculations 40 years ago was considered to be rocket science.
Would you work on an Apple app for value and derivatives?
You see, this is no different because I remember this is deja vu, that the same thing was done when the calculator was put up and said that you can use a Black-Scholes on my calculator.
Right.
But here's the challenge, Pat. Black-Scholes, how many real options and convertibles are European style? As soon as you move away from a European style option, unfortunately that app on that tool becomes useless.
Do you want to set accounting standards that are fit for purpose 40 or 50 years ago, or do you want essentially...
We can explore
more relevant information?
Yeah.
At this stage of the project, I would argue for that.
I think we've been given a pretty clear message by people that they don't want us to start with a blank sheet of paper. They want us to look at 32 and see what our problems are, right? So our problems with 32 is nobody really understands the logic behind fix or fixed. So my request to the staff was, can we think about adding to our toolkit to help us think about why we think fix or fixed is as it should be or shouldn't be, which I think needs to think about some performance-related stuff. I'd like open to be convinced otherwise, but I'm not convinced in the way Steve and Pat seem to be that in our sort of way of thinking that from a performance aspect, we would start remeasuring a pure fixed-for-fixed derivative. Even though it might be interesting to some people, I'm not sure it's consistent with our overall logic, but I just don't know that we've got the tool yet to answer that question. So I think we need to develop that, but really, with the mindset of thinking about what are our problems in 32 that we still be trying to fix, not what's our brand new idea of what to remeasure and not. So I'm not ignoring what these guys are saying. I just think we don't have a common tool that we're using at this board table to help us answer these questions.
Tuck?
Thank you. Just two things about the example two. And as Sue said, we don't really know why the fixed topic is equity. But simply, I think I take it very simply. If like you said, if you issue a share with a fixed number of cash, then that's the issuance of equity. Just a simple issuance of equity. So then only the timing is different. You receive it in the future. Then. If the number is fixed, then the same as the simple issuance of cash. So this is a very basic idea. But what happened in the foreign currency rights issue is, at that time I was a member of IFRIC, and as I remember, it was the fact pattern was quite simple, because rights are denominated in the foreign currency, so therefore it doesn't meet only because of the denomination of foreign currency. So we know that this is the equity issuance in a sense, and that it does meet the fixed condition. But because of the foreign currency, entire equity is could be remeasured as a liability. So then we made an exception. But at that time, there was a FICE project going on at the same time to meet the financial crisis. And at that time, we have lots of submission which relates to foreign currency issues and other derivative issues. But we make it very narrow because it was a very urgent issue and made it very, in a sense, peculiar exception. So for this particular issue, I could avoid such kind of issue only by could be some exception about just the foreign currency. So the current IS-21 is not very clear whether it's a measurement or it's just a translation. So if we take it as just a simple translation, not the part of the measurement, so the substance of the contract or substance of transaction should not be affected by foreign currency movement because it's simply translation. So if we take it in that way, we could avoid lots of issues relating to foreign currency issues. So, but just one thing. The other thing is more important about the interaction between performance and balance sheet. Yeah. Actually, the purpose of the statement is different. And profit and loss statement mainly focusing on the performance, but the balance sheet has a different purposes. So then the difficulty is interaction between performance and the balance sheet. And then actually this issue, we need to take a balance of it. So then in order to address this issue, we really need to come back to the performance reporting project. And also we have to think about interaction between performance reporting and the balance sheet. And then we have to know the what is the movement which is useful for the balance sheet, and what is the movement which is useful for the performance. And then we have to segregate all these two kinds of movement, and then put it on the balance sheet and performance report well. That is what is necessary. And actually, conceptual framework ED, not EDA, conceptual framework discussion paper was trying to challenge it. So I think we could reconsider such kind of approach.
Yes, there's one more paper. Okay.
There we go.
2 points. Firstly, on the componentization, I support PET. I feel, you know, it is not necessary for us to rule out now, you know, in his wording, you know, at least we have to, you know, keep it in. And of course, the staff saying, repeatedly saying, you know, it's paid off, or it's very complicated. This called me one event we faced in the past, but by then, issue solved, you know, no one cared. That is, when we discuss the own credit issue, explore four different approach. And actually, the final ones we discussed, it might be complicated. But by then, we use it. And we already know in the past, there's diverse practice. And the practice may be very complicated. But since, you know, people feel so important to highlight such changes from others, and everybody feel it is useful, then people say, don't worry about methodology, you know, we can solve this issue. Now, I think, you know, this some kind of, you know, maybe not exactly the same, but lessons we can learn. You know, sometimes we feel something very complicated, but when we make trade-off between usefulness of doing something and the possible complexity, I basically what I want to say, I support in the PET, we should not rule out at this stage. And secondly, I fully agree with what Taka said, you know, about in relation to foreign currency rights issues we faced several years ago during financial crisis. For me, I think the whole debate around this project is, as I explained in the past, we have enough methodology and weapons for liability, you know, itself, you know, present anyway. But the problem is some instruments in between liability equity, and whether we should expand a little bit, you know, the equity, the sections, and reflect some changes by some way. In Philippe's terms, maybe it's purely disclosure. For me, there's no difference between disclosure and presentation, you know, in relation to reflecting the changes in, among the different kinds of equities. I think foreign currency issue is, to some extent, is related to the different class of the ownership owners. So I think this is the key. Of course, it is not so easy. You know, in the past, we never defined subclass of equity. If you want to do so, then definition itself is not so easy. And then under what circumstances we want to remeasure, it's also not so easy. And if we say you should remeasure then what measurement basis, and finally how to reflect the changes will also not be so easy. But fundamentally, my feeling is, you know, the key of this project is to expand a little bit of equity sections and whether we can find ways to reflect the changes among different class of equity owners. And Taka finally mentioned about DP. I'm not sure whether you mean the same as I want to say, that is the to use the same changes of equity to reflect some of the dilution effect.
We're going to explore requirements for within equity. But again, I just want to reiterate, even if we do that, we're still going to get contracts that will have elements of both equity and non-equity. And we still have to make a decision about how those will need to be classified. And that's what this is trying to get to. So if it's classified as equity, we can explore opportunities to for presentation disclosure, et cetera. But we're still going to have to deal with these situations where the combinations of equity and non.
Mary?
Just one thing to add on the theme that Wigwa was also mentioning, which is dilution. You know, as I'm thinking through some of the things that we've been talking about today, our earlier discussions, explorations around these issues, one of the very first papers that we discussed, I can't remember which one, I think identified a desire for interest in dilution as one of the drivers of classification itself being a blunt instrument to get information to users of financial statements. If it's something even as simple as a written call on own shares, there's interest in knowing whether that written option goes into the money or not. You know, right now we don't answer that except through EPS, but dilution is one of the things that may be in the back of people's minds in terms of driving either decisions we have in the standards about, you know, when you classify something as liability, so that you get some accounting recognition of fluctuations in value, and may also be in people's minds when they talk about do answers make sense and are they getting the information that they're looking for. I don't think it's the whole answer, but I think it's one of the drivers. The reason I bring it up in this context and again, not so much looking for an answer now as to ask staff to think about it, is to me dilution for the dilutive effect of instruments could be better portrayed than it is now in basically EPS. I would look to do more the kind of thing we explored in the DP for conceptual framework with an expanded statement of equity to show things going in or out of the money and what that means in terms of dilutive effect to other classes of shareholders. And the reason I bring that up now, and the thing that I don't want you to try and ask, is if we say that our presumption is that an expanded statement of equity or something like that is a good way to show dilution, does that in any way simplify some notion of splitting out components? And the reason I ask this is, if with REO part of what we were trying to capture was the probability, you know, valuing the probability of exercise or the in-the-money, out-of-the-money aspect, if we find a way to separate out the information that people have told us they're looking for in terms of expanded information about dilution, does that then help us to draw some lines in terms of classification as liability, classification as equity? And I guess what I'm saying is this may be one of the performance-related tools that Sue was saying, you know, we might be looking for in terms of helping with classification of instruments. So I just want to ask the staff, as you're looking at follow-ups on this morning's discussion, to think about dilution and capture, you know, how we capture dilution as maybe one of the things we could take out of the tangle of things that we're trying to address, and yet give information to users of financial statements, maybe even more than they get today, about the dilutive effects.
We're going to explore those, and I think, can I just sum up what I heard, Sue, and then we can...
I was just going to make a comment on bifurcation.
Yeah, go ahead.
Which is just,
I can imagine us fast getting to a place where we'll think sometimes we're empathetic and sometimes we're not. So I might be very empathetic to an entity who's got shares listed in different currencies all around the world, entering into a forward contract in one of those currencies to sell my own shares. And if an entity who's just got sterling shares entering into a forward in New Zealand dollars for the hell of it, not being such a nice thing and not being as empathetic, or I sell my shares based on gold prices and I'm a gold producer or not, I'm going to think differently about it. Just worry we're going to very soon get into closely related type criteria as well.
Hey, can I just sum up what I've heard?
One comment before we can sum. Is it okay?
Yes.
Sorry. So based on all these discussions, do we have any kind of evidence in markets? Are they responding our some kind of some incompleteness of information of current accounting standards? In terms of, for example, foreign currency rights issue, people are thinking this is a liability rather than equity.
Well,
or some the fixed for fixed principle, there are some weaknesses.
We have existing requirements where we treat two similar things, which would be foreign currency rights issue, in different ways, depending on some other criteria. So that has come to us before, and we have made the exception.
Mm-hmm.
And so these transactions do occur outside that.
They're common.
They're quite common.
They're common.
Are you talking about the empirical research or about actual practice?
Both, maybe. Yeah, maybe both. but I'm saying maybe if the markets are very so smart and they're efficient, they will do all kinds of reactions.
Oh, yeah.
As many people have just suggested. So if there's some kind of the market reaction to our current classification and performance reporting and balance sheet information, if they do, that reaction might be a good maybe some starting point to make our standards better.
The question is whether the markets react exactly as we think the accounting should lead them to react, or do they react differently? Mm-hmm. We know markets react to dilution, reduction.
Yeah.
But is it based only on the accounting analysis or
something
is it
else?
A bit different?
Yeah. It's very difficult.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'll just quickly sum up. So what I've heard is some acknowledgement of the trade-offs and how we potentially might deal with it. So what I'm thinking is, going forward, what we can do is we can develop fix for fix a bit more, see how we can chisel it a bit, sharpen it, and look at some specific areas where we can deal with those special cases. And identify those special cases. I think the board would also like to develop some further rationale about why we're okay with fixed for fixed instruments being classified as equity. And we heard some comments about that will give us some direction with regards to that. Apart from Pat and perhaps Steve, I didn't get too much appetite for looking at some more sophisticated approach to componentization. And sorry, Wegwe. So what I suggest is, let us see how far we get with chiseling and fix for fix, and we can see if the board would be happy with that, and then if not, then we can take it from there.
I also heard, if I understood Steve and Pat correctly, I think they question whether or not even a fix for fix should in some way be measured.
Yes.
Whereas others, I think, are comfortable with fix for fix not being remeasured, but want the other bits potentially separated
out.
Well,
we're going to think about the stuff within equity that was raised, okay, and looking at additional disclosures and presentation, we're always going to do that. So whatever gets classified as equity, we're going to think about requirements for that. But I think just in terms of as a mechanism for classification, we'll just develop fix for fix a bit further, look at how we need to adapt it to the approaches and chisel out some of those special cases, and then we'll see how we go with that.
Mariam, can I ask a question? It's in your paper, sorry. Paragraph, almost the last paragraph, 114. And you say that we should first consider the challenge for other types of derivatives. I'm understanding from previous discussion that the other types are the most sophisticated ones you mentioned, COCOs and CI puts. So
exactly. That's right. So we still need to think about some of the more complicated types of derivatives. And that's what I was saying. I think we need to look at how the existing requirements might apply to that and how we can adapt them for that and see where we get to before
go further.
Thank
you.
Man, on your summary, the thing that I didn't hear that I heard in the conversation was the point that Sue raised initially about do we need a tool
for
performance.
I meant by looking at whether there's some kind of underlying rationale for why we're okay with that.
Okay.
I meant to capture that in that comment. Should we move on to the redemption obligation requirements now?
Yes, please.
And I think in some ways this is a bit easier because I think it's the main point with the redemption obligation requirements is that they only apply to these types of exchanges where we're exchanging equity for liabilities or liability for equity. So these are in addition to fixed for fixed and why we've looked at them especially. So we've illustrated these three different arrangements. The key thing is that all three of those examples that we illustrate in paragraph 72-103, the arrangement may result in the entity paying an amount of 100 currency units after 1 year, or the holder of or the counterparty to that arrangement ends up waiving that payment in exchange for keeping or receiving a fixed amount of ordinary shares. And so the difference between the arrangements is in how the arrangements are expressed. And so in example 4, it's expressed as a bond with conversion option, whereas in example 5, it's expressed as a share with put option. However, both arrangements provide the holder with downside protection, and both arrangements provide the holder of the counterparty with the upside potential that might arise with any appreciation of the shares. Now, under IAS 32, the accounting for the two arrangements is quite similar, and I tried to tease that out. However, it's achieved with different requirements and in different paragraphs. The benefits are that we end up with similar accounting for similar economic arrangements. However, the differences between the requirements give rise to some questions about whether they are the same in all cases. There are some application problems because some requirements are more complete than the others, and there's some gaps that we need to fill. Okay, and lastly, because these are exchanges of liability and equity, where we end up with the distinction between liabilities and equity will obviously have an effect on what the populations are. And so we're going to have to develop changes or amendments or further develop the redemption obligation to accommodate where we end up on the underlying approach for the distinction between liabilities and equity. But I think that's just an obvious type of point. And of course, we're going to have to think about improving the consistency, clarity, and completeness of the requirements as we go forward. At this point, I'll just turn it over. I think this is slightly easier than the fix for fix because we're looking at something a little bit different. But if you have any questions or comments on how we're moving forward, I'd be happy to receive them.
Everybody exhausted from exhaustion. Sheer exhaustion kicking in. Okay.
Yeah, that's it.
All right. Thank you very much.